Picture the scene.
As the COVID-19 case load increases with a positivity rate of 22.6%.
It's June 2020. The world has more or less shut down.
And taking steps to tighten travel restrictions.
Borders are closed.
The variant feared to be the worst yet was identified in Southern Africa.
Everyone is grappling with a new reality of face masks, sanitizers, and social distancing. It's a rough time, especially for those in the tourism and hospitality industry. And in this space, a post pops up on social media. The post came from a travel agency, and it was inviting locals to visit a hotel in Nairobi. The hotel in question is highly photogenic, loved by influencers, an Instagram grid staple. And included in the post were four words, opening just for Kenyans. And if you were scrolling through, you might have seen it as a harmless enough invitation. But for its Kenyan audience, it hit a nerve. For some time now, there's been a conversation about Kenyans not feeling welcome in their own country when it comes to tourism. And so, a fiery discussion ensued.
It's a shame that you're now willing to welcome Kenyans to your establishment.
They're only welcoming us because the dollars
are. How is it now open to Kenyans while it's in Kenya?
Your business model relied on foreign tourists before and was designed to lock out Kenyans through pricing. Then you need to maintain the same energy
now. Not interested in your offer? Please wait for your international guests.
Hashtag keep it.
Not everyone agreed. There were those who felt that it was just a case of unfortunate wording and that the anger was misplaced. The hotel denied practicing any type of discrimination. But what was clear, though, was that this discussion was about much more than access to the single establishment. It pointed to a more nuanced and layered conversation about history, race, money, and access. And so in this episode, I'm going to try and unravel some of those layers with the help of a tour guide, a travel writer, and an entrepreneur. I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
I wanted to start somewhere synonymous with tourism, the Nairobi National Park. So I headed there at 6 a.m. one chilly morning.
So welcome again to Nairobi National Park. We are at the main gate, and this is the oldest park to be established.
This is Felix Migoya, a tour guide, photographer and vlogger. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of Kenya's parks and wildlife.
Just two buffaloes.
Yeah, buffaloes. There must be a bigger herd somewhere. So these ones are coming, I think, to drink water.
Very big, but this is general size, right?
These are full-grown buffaloes.
Full-grown buffaloes.
Felix has been in the business long enough to have had one or two very close encounters.
So I went down to pee. And then just when I was about to do my business, then this lion jumped.
It jumped. And then Felix?
And then when it jumped, it looked at me. So our eyes were like connected. And then for 2 seconds, and then it started running away.
It ran away?
Yes.
Well, that is an unusual outcome.
It didn't want to get wet.
Within an hour, we've spotted rhinos, black and white, a bloat of hippos quietly frolicking in the water, a gang of unbothered buffaloes, a handful of giraffes, countless impalas, and the oddest looking bird I have ever seen is called a Cory Bustard. I'll put a photo of one up in our Facebook page.
I used to see these safari vans with guests traveling from the southern parts to the interland, that is Nairobi and the rest of the country.
Felix is explaining what first got him interested in tour guiding as a profession.
So I started developing, you know, admiration for those guys, saying that, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I could also travel and meet new people and also see different places.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how long have you been a tour guide for?
I have been a tour guide for, this is the 17th year, going into 18.
Okay. And do you enjoy it?
I enjoy it. But just like any other job, sometimes it has its ups and downs.
What are the downs? What are the downsides?
The downside is, tourism industry is it's like a seasonal industry. So sometimes you find yourself out of work for a while. And then during peak season, things are good. And then also we have challenges related to the jobs, you know, the people that you meet, the kind of tourists that you encounter. So such experiences, they differ.
One clear downside is having to deal with badly behaved tourists who want selfies with wild animals.
Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And there was this incident, one of the guests got out of the car. He wanted to take a very close-up picture of a lion. A male lion was like 3 meters from the car. And that was only risky for him, but also risky to the whole group. We had to grab him by force and then get him back to the car. Yes.
Felix has only been lost once. And this was way back when he was just starting out.
I was out in the Mara. You know, Masai Mara is this big, vast area full of plains. So I got lost within the first 5 kilometers of getting out from the lodge, you know. I made 2 turns and then I couldn't tell where I was. So it was a bit embarrassing.
Who were your clients back then when you were starting out?
Back then, my clients were expatriates who were working in Kenya. And then through them, I got referrals. So I had guests directly from the US most of the time.
More recently, Felix has seen more tourists from China and India. But for most of his career, it has been Americans, who he appreciates as clients because they tell it like it is.
Most of them are straightforward. When there's something wrong, they'll just tell you there and then.
And there are many British tourists, too, who Felix says are a little less inclined to speak their minds.
But the British are a little bit reserved. They would, smile in your face. And then after leaving, they go and write like a 10-page email saying, oh, this guy's like this, this guy. Instead of just telling you straight
one
there
star.
And then. Yes. You know, hiding behind, you know, a smile.
But there is one group that has been conspicuously absent.
When I started, there were no locals at all.
That's right.
No, back then, there were no Kenyans at all. None that I can remember.
Yeah. And why did you think that was back then?
So back then, tourism was misconceived to be a Mzungu affair.
Mzungu, by the way, is a Swahili word for a white person.
So in that, the local people believed that only Mzungus can afford to travel, that is. Yes, and also it's only the Mzungus who could afford to go to these tourist hotels. Because these 5-star hotels, or any star-rated hotels, we thought that they were for the Mzungus only. That was the misconception then. So it was a 99% Mzungu affair.
And where do you think that misconception comes from, like tracing the roots of that misconception, that belief?
I think it can be traced back into the colonial times because the first tour companies that we had were Western-owned. Mm-hmm. And they used to employ mostly Westerners. Mm-hmm. And then the customers were basically Westerners. So the black Africans then were employed only as either cooks or butlers or, janitors back then. So we never had guides who were black. The only elevated role they would do is to drive. Because the language was also a barrier. Because the colonialists who came, they could speak to other guests in English. But the local people, they could only speak Swahili. But the white masters, they mastered Swahili. But the local people are not allowed to, either to study English first so that they can interact with guests, or they were never allowed to interact with guests, to speak to them, that is. Yeah, so that was one of the factors which, made the local people not to venture much into either tour guiding or into the tourism business.
A quick historical detour. In the 1920s, it became increasingly popular for expats and other Western holidaymakers to go on safari tours to enjoy Kenya's wildlife. The colonial administration began building facilities and infrastructure, so more Westerners began to holiday on the coast or go on hunting expeditions. Indigenous Kenyans were really involved in the decision-making when it came to tourism planning and participation. When Kenya became independent in 1963, the goal to decolonize the economy was hampered by falling agricultural export revenues. At the same time, the government could see how tourism could be a way to bring in more revenue. So incentives and concessions were made to attract foreign investment. This meant a large degree of foreign ownership. It also meant that the framing of Kenya as a tourist destination was done with wealthy American and European visitors in mind. A place of bountiful wildlife, breathtaking sunset, and smiling black waiters.
As time went by, it started bothering me because more and more Kenyans were getting economically empowered, and so they could afford to travel. But that tiny misconception that, tourism is for the Mzungu was still there.
Felix says that with the growing middle class, things were changing. But there were also competing ideas about how people chose to spend their money and time.
The idea of tourism was sort of different in the local context. For me, the idea of a safari is not going into a game park or a game reserve. My idea of a safari is to go out on a weekend with a bunch of friends. We go drink beer and eat nyamachoma. Or maybe getting your kids going into rural home, visiting your grandmother.
When do you think that started to shift?
That started to change, I would say 7 to 8 years back, when there was an explosion of information technology. Internet opened up our eyes. And then the changes that happened in the tourism industry, we had young entrepreneurs coming up. And then these young entrepreneurs, they started, showing tourism in a different way. Instead of the traditional hotels that were there, that were meant for the Mzungus, we had investors who started investing in mid-range hotels, which people could afford, the local person can afford. And also, the young entrepreneurs, who are very important in the tourism value chain, they started coming out with products which were actually deviated from the normal tourism that, the usual game parks. And also, the demand from the clientele also informed what we had to do. So we had to change. We had to, shift. So that is when things started changing and we started seeing, people traveling, that local people traveling, because there was an alternative place to visit. There was an alternative place to stay. And then there was alternative cost. Yes, so that is when things started changing.
No, it's okay, it's okay. I worked it out that this will be
sorry to keep you guys waiting.
No, don't worry.
Do you want something to drink?
What I have often focused on and written about in the past couple of years and what I have been learning about is to do with land rights and indigenous people's rights, because a lot of these touristic activities and sort of things like that happen on land, and that land was not empty before these things started happening. So there are many, I've heard them called conservation refugees.
This is Julie. She is 28 and does many things, including travel writing. She's traveled extensively within Kenya and also in Southern Africa, Western Europe and the US.
And your style of traveling is?
It's much more budget, backpacker, a bit more communal. It's also a bit more, I really appreciate long-term travel. So I've done quite a lot of work exchanges, volunteering in a place in exchange for a free place to stay. So I've done that for 2 weeks at Fangano Island.
I wanted her to help me unpick some of the knottier issues around race and access within the tourism industry. I had gone down a bit of a rabbit hole, looking at all the different conversations around race and access in Kenya. And I came across numerous headlines like Kenyans demand fair treatment in leading hotels as they celebrate Christmas holidays, or the unspoken scourge of racism in Kenyan tourist hotels. And there have been other social media groups created with the specific purpose of exposing racism in Kenya's tourism industry.
I think Kenya is very good at like rallying on social media, particularly Twitter. It's like a national sport. Honestly, it's a marvel. It's like some things get done, you know what I mean? Things that need to get changed sometimes. Like, it's very effective. But
so there is an ongoing conversation about how certain locals sometimes feel disregarded and disrespected by the industry, the travel industry?
Yeah, there are definitely instances of that. It can be many different things. The most obvious thing is sort of seeing differences in treatment in terms of service, whether it is literally restaurants or hotels or even tour operators and travel agents. In terms of just the quality of service, so it's not uncommon that somebody with maybe a very clearly African name, mm-hmm. or like a very much more local accent, mm-hmm. or something like, or speaking a local language, mm-hmm. It might be either not served as politely or literally told, you know, there are no availabilities, things like that, or this and that is not allowed, this accommodation cannot be made for you, for whatever your needs are. But if somebody else was to call, and people do this sometimes, people test it, they're like, okay, let me give somebody else the phone with their like French surname or whatever it is, or with their accent, and see if they say the same thing. It's not uncommon in a couple of places and in a couple of instances where the story will switch. And now, yeah, we can definitely do that for you, or there is availability, or, you know, we will. That's a thing that happens. I wouldn't say it's common, mm-hmm. that so explicitly like that, mm-hmm. but there is definitely often that vibe and that air in many establishments.
This targeting of certain clients can be overt too.
But as far as I know, I've seen a couple where there isn't even an office in Kenya. Like bookings go through a UK number or a German number, and like the office is not even here.
Wow.
Like, yeah, you can see us, but like, this isn't for you. Like, why are you talking to us? Like, so I think many people's attitude or people's belief is that where the money is in the Western world. Where the money is with European and American visitors. And if you're trying to, you know, have consistent business or trying to get good tips if you're in service and things like that, then that is where you look. And Africans and whoever else doesn't do that. Doesn't do that or doesn't, that's not where the money is, sort of thing. I've heard other people say...
It seems that parts of the industry have been slow or perhaps reluctant to adapt to the changing tastes of clients.
Again, with an old tourism industry like what we have here, people, particularly in older establishments and people who have been in the industry for a long time in service or in management or whatever, have been accustomed to maybe their clientele have been mainly German, that have been mainly Italian. And that's quite different to what the average Kenyan or Tanzanian does in terms of what they prefer to eat and drink, or what they prefer in their room at a hotel. You know what I mean? Like, maybe some people prefer TV and other people prefer to have like nature sounds only. Maybe some people are traveling in a group to have parties and others are traveling for like silence.
Yeah.
And maybe some.
So when that post popped up, Julie says she understood the anger, but she wanted to broaden the discussion.
So for me, I was like, I'm glad this is being talked about because it can open this conversation of, in my opinion or in my view, it was sort of, maybe we need to stop and evaluate what places we see as aspirational. Yeah, you know, it's very nice, but there are other very nice places. You know, that's very unique. There are other very unique experiences in the same area and in other parts of Kenya and the world. So for me, it was like, why don't we talk about why this place, which is really, the vibe of it is very, like a lot of the safari industry, is very rooted in that sort of like nostalgia of the colonial era, again, of hunting parties. So it's like, okay, so what are we glorifying and why? It's up to us as consumers, I would say, to just kind of start to really pay attention to what it is that we support.
Yeah, and the views are so dope here. Yeah.
Oh, now this. Yeah. Now this is a view.
Yeah. Enjoy it.
I'm going to try to describe the view, but I don't think I can do it justice, but it's just the greenest green I've ever seen. And it's just like rolling hills. And then all you can hear is birdsong. There's a nice breeze. One warm weekday afternoon, I went hiking with Mary, my producer, and Alex Kamau, a 29-year-old outdoor enthusiast. He had suggested a route that took us through a tea estate, past acres of dense green tea bushes, and along a stream. Alex is part of a new wave of Kenyans who are taking a different approach to domestic tourism, moving away from the old model that focused on luxury safaris and expensive tours, The new movement is all about embracing and accessing Kenya's natural heritage on their own terms.
Yeah, so my name is Alex Kamau. I'm 29 years old. I would call myself an outdoor enthusiast. My life every single day revolves around the outdoors, either me being on the outdoors and planning on how to take people to the outdoors safely and in a way that they enjoy and love. Yeah, and I've been doing that for the last 3 years.
Now, you suggested we meet here in this particular place. 3.5 years ago, Alex was in the middle of a crisis.
I remember feeling a lot of, like, a sort of an existential crisis. Were you out of college? Yes, you were well-learned. You got a good education. But when you come to the real world, it's a clash of expectations. So I went through what they now call a quarter-life crisis.
Quarter-life crisis.
Yeah. So I remember packing up after college and I went back to live with my parents, which was so unlikely because you don't leave college and go back to live with your parents, you know. But for me, it felt like, I am not sure whether I really want to go out and look for a 9-to-5 job. I'm looking for something adventurous. And this is something I've always even told my friends, that I don't know what I want, but I know what I don't want.
What did you not want?
I knew that I didn't want to end up in a 9-to-5 environment. And that I was looking for an environment where I feel I'm more engaged. There's a lot of activity. There's a lot of interesting problems to handle. So I was very clear from the word go. Even I remember telling my parents who would come up with brochures of work and everything, but like, nah, I don't want that.
Alex is the founder of Let's Drift, a company that describes itself as a community of adventurers. Using a subscription model, you pay a modest monthly fee and then join as many trips as you like for camping, hiking, chasing waterfalls. But all of it is tied to seeing and appreciating the country differently.
I'm here with Michelle. Michelle, you want to say hi?
Hi, guys.
So tell us where we're going today.
Oh, today we're going to Buxton Tunnel. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to the Buxton Tunnel to and fro. No, it ideally should be to and fro, but we'll only...
It's a model of travel and exploration that puts its emphasis on affordability and accessibility.
When I was growing up, you know, my parents would either pay for your fees. You know, I mean, there was no much of what right now we normally call as extra income, where, you know, disposable income, where you're able to spend money with a vacation. So we didn't get to experience that because, I mean, except for recently because of more accessibility in terms of information, safaris have been expensive, you know. So much that even my grandfather was a safari driver for the longest time. It couldn't even be accessed by his family, you know. So I think with that you can see the extent to which it was even unimaginable for a normal Kenyan family to, like, say, you know, we're packing up and we're going to the Mara, you know. So I think, yeah, the accessibility and the affordability of it was very hard.
Alex says things really took off during lockdown.
That's when we saw a spike of people seeking the outdoors. And that's when now the audience started diversifying from, you know, millennials to, you know, older folks to Gen Z to families and their kids. Mm. So I think the pandemic kind of shaped our community. It shaped even the hiking as a hobby entirely, yeah.
From a personal perspective, yeah. How much has it opened it up for you? I'd like to know, like, yeah. from where you started, how yeah. much you knew of what's around you yeah. to now.
Yeah. I think it's opened up a lot. I think the places of being that is just around Nairobi itself is so much that you could never have ever imagined that these places are available. You know, our tagline has always been to stay curious, you know, like we believe there is some place undiscovered somewhere that needs, a place that needs to be discovered. There's a hill, there's a waterfall, there's a forest somewhere that needs to be discovered. But all you need is to have that mindset of, you know, it's not just the conventional places we know, mm-hmm. but there's always an unconventional place that no one knows about, and if you can find it and tell the story of that place, people can discover it and enjoy it. I think it started as a cover showing people, hey, it's not just about safari, mm-hmm. you know, Kenya is a diverse country. There's hiking, there's climbing, there's biking, there's so much, you know, you can do. There's yoga, there's so much that you can do aside from just going and watching games.
The issue of who is tourism for is not unique to Kenya. It's a conversation happening all over the continent. But perhaps what is unique is the strength of feeling both online and offline, around not only being able to access existing places, but also about creating something new for Kenyans, by Kenyans.
This is built by us, for us, and to us. Like, it's we built this lift to represent what our generation wants to become and the aspirations they're looking for. So, I mean, we don't need to sit down and talk about diversity because it's really built from the ground up.
This episode was produced by me, Kim Chakaneta, Mary Goodhart and Aisha Afra. Mary also did the sound design. Piers Lynch is our editor. Our studio manager is Derek Clark.